This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 86, brought to you in association with Smart Pension, Synchron, and Archover. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Nick Ogden, Executive Chairman of ClearBank, to discuss clearing banking. We've been fortunate on the show to have some great entrepreneurs and a few several times round, but I believe Nick takes not just the biscuit, but the whole Jaffa cake. Nick is a real deal, a real serial entrepreneur. Just to give you a first and a footsie. The first is Nick formed Multimedia Investments Limited, a technology research and development company that brought the internet to the Channel Islands. Not such a big deal, you might think. However, check out the date, 1993. And the FTSE, in 1993, Nick founded the company that became Worldpay, which is now FTSE 100. In 2014, Nick created ClearBank, and in 2017, it launched to be the first new clearing bank in the UK for 250 years. Its mission is to create greater competition, transparency, and bring leading-edge technology to the banking market. 250 years ago is certainly a little while, so let's dive once again into history to understand the roots of where we are today. The last episode, in covering money, dived into the history, and we had the stat that 97% of these days of what we think of as money is actually debt owed to banks. Interestingly, in medieval England, it was almost exactly the opposite. No banks, and about 97% of all transactions were for credit, not debt, i.e. you would get something now and pay later. That mass murderer of wives and destroyer of the monasteries, King Henry VIII, did away with the prohibition of interest-based lending, and modern banking as we know it came into being. Lombard Street, at the heart of the city, is from Lombardy, the Italian bankers having taken over from the Jews, who were the only ones previously allowed to lend money at interest, hence the Merchant of Venice. Englishmen followed the Italian example, and in particular Sir Thomas Gresham was a pioneer of lending and borrowing money, and hence Gresham Street. The first UK cheque we have a record of is from 1659 and was drawn on a goldsmith, for the reasons we discussed last time, based upon money in those days being a real thing, not some bullshit numbers in a computer as we have now. At the start of the 19th century, there were some 800 banks outside London, and it's important to recall in our modern speedy society that the country took far longer to traverse, and before any form of electronic communications, exchanging cheques around the country and other such pieces of paper was a complete nightmare, and here we have the origins of clearing banks who sorted all this out. Before ClearBank came along, there were formerly 11 clearing banks in the UK. Bank of England, Bank of Scotland, Barclays, Clydesdale, Co-op, HSBC, Lloyds, NatWest, Nationwide, RBS, Santander UK, and now ClearBank. Sadly though, as far as I know, cheques are rather going out of fashion in the UK, so maybe ClearBank's a little bit late to the game. Sounds like a good question to ask Nick later. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Nick, thanks for joining me today.
Pleasure.
So I hear you like yellow cars and cars with lots of engines in them or big engines in them or something.
Yeah, I suppose we all have a failure in life, don't we?
I have many actually, not just one.
I have to listen to your podcast then at some stage. But no, I sort of enjoy whizzing around in fast cars and have had a few fun moments. I think the most memorable one I've still actually got the video of was taking the president of the UK GTR Owners Club around the F1 circuit at Silverstone. In a Spec V GTR that I was lucky to own at the time. And after the fifth lap, he was almost hanging out of the window, pleading that we went into the pits really quickly before he'd destroyed my upholstery in the car.
And I like to sort of fool myself that I'm a polite person, so maybe I shouldn't ask the question of whether this was because you were driving so badly or whether we were driving so fast.
I was doing okay. We only had one small spin-off, and I don't think that helped him very much. But it's good fun.
I did back in that day when I had a life. I'm regaining my life, actually, because my youngest daughter's now just finished school, so I feel like a human being again. But back in the day before children, I did actually go to Brands Hatch and do quite a few weekends of what was then the Nigel Mansell Racing Club.
Yep.
And you get some proper driver to take you around in a sort of a normal car and show you how to drive completely from scratch. And then they'd put you in a single-seater, open-top car where you're incredibly close to the ground. And unless you've actually driven with your arse 6 inches off the ground, you don't know what speed feels like.
Yep.
In a modern car. And whatever it is, that bend after hanging straight or something, I did actually approach it a little too fast at one time. did a complete 360 degrees. Unfortunately, I was pointing in the right direction, so I carried on. But it's one of those things, it's faster than the sort of the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
It's happened, and you go, oh, that happened.
It's really good fun. And if you get a track day or something, two lessons, really. One is don't have a large breakfast. And the second one is to make sure that you're actually driving somebody else's car. Then it's a perfect day out.
Yes, indeed. Well, since then, I've rather sort of abandoned the world of fast cars because I was a long-term fan of Formula One, but that became too much of a circus for me. And I've switched over to MotoGP and motorbikes. I'm not a motorbikist, but they are the last of the real gladiators. And talking of Silverstone, last weekend, of course, the MotoGP and Moto2 and Moto3, the three formats, were at Silverstone. And there was an incredible day where actually it was sunny and not windy, which is very rare for an ex-airfield.
Yep.
So, moving on from the London Motorcar podcast to something a little bit near finance, although it's always a good indicator on the show that quite a number of my guests actually quite like fast cars, and this, of course, is a sort of sign of success. Banking making more money than it used to back in the day when I started in the city, and a story I may have told before, when I started in the city, the new graduates at Klein Watts in 1985 went to the chairman to complain they weren't making enough money to live on, literally. I mean, they were earning like £6,500, which that meant it wasn't enough to live on London. Things have changed. So your career journey, as I mentioned in passing, you founded lots of extremely successful companies and all that kind of stuff. And I guess one thing led to another and led to another.
Yeah, I've been, I guess, very, very fortunate. I was around when the internet was being created. I was actually involved in electronic publishing. We were doing a lot of work with Sony. This is back in 1992. We went along to a book fair at that famous London knocking shop, the Hammersmith Novotel, to basically look at latest products and all the rest of it. In the corner of the room where the book fair was on, with a group of guys with anoraks looking at some computers and looking at a product called Mosaic. And Mosaic, as you will know, is the original browser which came out, which started to allow graphical user interface access to online systems. And online systems prior to that had been all text-based and were very, very difficult to manipulate. And you know, sometimes you get a vision of the future, you see something, you think that's going to transform things. Well, that was the view that I took of Mosaic. It fixed a number of different issues that I was aware of in relation to providing access to data and all the rest of it. And so we basically put some cash together and put an internet connection into Jersey in the Channel Islands, which is where I lived. And in 1994, we became an ISP. Now, we didn't know they were called ISPs then because nobody called them ISPs. And our customer service was absolutely awful. I remember one conversation with one guy who was explaining to somebody on the phone who couldn't get the three floppy disks we'd sent to them with a copy of Mosaic on them working, that TCP was not something that they rubbed on their knee. It was actually a protocol that was used in communications. And, you know, we've come some way from that.
Yes. It is amazing how the world has completely changed. I mean, I was just suffering at the dentist before this. Fortunately, not too much. Otherwise, I'd be really mumbling. I've got to get back to suffer more for my sins. And he was asking about the podcast and saying that it would be inconceivable, even 20 years ago, to sort of walk around with a recorder, record somebody, and before you know it, 4,000, 5,000 people in 163 countries in the world have listened.
Yeah.
We're so used to it because we've grown up while this is happening, but when you stop and pinch yourself, it is quite amazing. It's like one of the Apollo astronauts. I've forgotten which one now. He set up the Institute for Noetic Sciences. His name escapes me. Anyway, he was saying that he grew up on a farm with horse and cart.
Yeah.
And he was one of the first men on the moon, you know, in the space of one lifetime.
It's 23 years ago that the commercial internet arrived. So it's, you know, it's yesterday. It's not years and years ago. And I think that if you look back now, you know, over the course of the last 23 years, nobody realised that it was almost like an invisible tsunami coming in to attack many, many industries and change the way that we all operate and live forever. You know, 23 years ago, if you wanted to go and buy something or communicate with somebody, you would walk down the street or you get in the car, you get a bus, or in London, you get on the underground, you'd go somewhere, look at something and buy it. Today, you look at your computer, you look at your smartphone or whatever, and you'll probably buy it that way around. The whole way that we interact, both from an economic and commercial perspective, and communicate from a social perspective, as demonstrated by your podcast, has just gone upside down.
Yes, I think the only good things about the internet are probably my podcast, of course, and Amazon, in that my last-minute Christmas panic has made much easier by, as you say, being able to do it on the phone. I'm not sure the rest of the internet's any good, really, because we've talked about social media on the podcast before, and all the evidence is, especially amongst young people, that social media causes depression and huge stress amongst people to live up to stuff, and you're proven to be less depressed if you go off Facebook. And like you, I remember the world of work before there were emails. And it's fantastic because there are these things called weekends and holidays. And
yeah, I had an experience this week, actually, which I hadn't done for a while. I actually put a stamp on an envelope.
Oh, right, okay.
To what they've still got those red boxes.
Yes. There,
and apparently it works.
Yes, yes, yes. And life went on. Okay, well, that's actually quite a good lead-in, talking of sort of red boxes, because I think red boxes were probably invented roughly the same time as clearing bank. And as I mentioned in the introduction, my extensive research has told me that clearing banking is something to do with checks, and checks are going out of fashion. And I've had lots of people who are doing something new, hot and sexy on the show, as you can imagine. But aren't you 250 years too late? Your greatest idea now is a little bit older than your first great idea in 1990-something.
Well, I think you have to check the facts out.
Yeah, well, I never do that.
Checks were an instrument that we used. Bills of exchange were an instrument that we used. And you were absolutely right in your summary that clearing banks used to move those between parties and effectively honour them either by providing the cash back or whatever was required to facilitate the completion of the transaction that was envisaged by the instrument that had been issued. If I issue a cheque for £30 today, you believe and hope that in due course £30 will arrive in your bank account. And ordinarily, that's what happens. Following the arrival of the cheques and then with evolution and history moving forward, in the 1950s we started to get into computerisation. Electronic payments were born out of that because cheques are a pain.
I keep telling my father, he keeps sending me them every now and then. I've actually converted him into using, although he stopped, he forgot about it. I've got a Monzo card, and the good thing about Monzo, you can do Monzo Me, which is basically you can send somebody a web link and they type their details in, and I keep trying to do that. But anyway, otherwise he still sends me cheques, he's the only one.
Well, listen, if he gets really bored with doing that and you don't want them, I'll give you my address at the end of the podcast, because I was definitely bank them. But the way that we all communicate and transact is moving very, very rapidly. Transactional banking is the lifeblood of our economy. Every consumer, every business, every government body, every organisation uses transactional banking all the time, 24/7/365. Without it, our economy stops. It's that simple.
So the basic point I'd glossed over, which is that clearing banks did indeed start by swapping pieces of paper amongst themselves for the general benefit. But in the way of things, they pivoted, they had mission creep, and they started doing sort of swapping bits.
Bits and bytes. Bits and bytes.
And everything, as you say, is now bits and bytes, and money is bits and bytes, and they switch them around. And to somebody like me who joined the city pre-Big Bang, phrases like stockbrokers, merchant banks, clearing banks, and that actually have some meaning. But I think it might be helpful for people less ancient than myself. Nick, if you could just explain what clearing banking is per se, insofar as most people these days and people who are more recently in the world of work will be more familiar with the universal banks, the likes of HSBC or Citigroup, that does everything. And then, you know, it's kind of, you know, which floor of Citigroup, as it were, do you do stuff?
All right, quick potted history. And I apologise to any listener who is about to fall asleep and it's probably, you know, that now's the time to go and put the kettle on moment or something like that. But the potted history really is that over the years there have been a plethora of clearing banks in the UK. In 1960, there were 16 clearing banks, and that's consolidated down to now 4, 5 with the arrival of ClearBank. And the definition of a clearing bank is, you were right in your summary, they clear transactions through for their customers and clients, but the 5 key clearing banks in the UK, which now includes ClearBank, clear financial transactions for other financial institutions. That's the difference. That was the market sector that we wanted to move in and the market sector we wanted to change in relation to the technology that we built in here. So what you have in the marketplace is a range of different payment schemes, faster payments, chaps and backs, the ones that everybody will know, faster payments you use within your online banking application. Chaps is the system that moves your mortgage around when you go and buy a house, and backs handles your direct debits and all the various other things that work. 4 banks controlled effectively the market for those services to the financial services marketplace. And they did it because of historic consolidation of the market, not for any other reasons. In 2014, when I was looking at, you know, how the market could change, I suggested to the then interim payment service regulator that to transform the UK financial services market, a new clearing bank was required. And it's a bit like you could draw a parallel between, you know, what's happened in supermarket retailing, where we used to have just, you know, Waitrose and Tesco's and Sainsbury's and Asda, and every, you know, month or so there'd be something in the news about their market share and we all glazed over, it was meaningless to us. And then 2 upstarts arrived, Lidl and Aldi, and everybody said, oh, they're just selling cheap food. And the reality was they were selling food more cheaply because of a different business model.
Yes, and I think actually I did see, I think it was Lidl a couple of years ago, did get the supermarket champagne of Christmas award from some newspaper, so it's not like they were selling shit.
No, they weren't. It was a completely different model, which meant their products were cheaper. They've now got 10 or 12% of the market share. As a new entrant, they were able to create competition, improve the lots of consumers, which is increasingly important, and change the dynamics of the marketplace. Incumbents weren't probably necessarily happy, but that's the way, in a proper competitive marketplace, that's how we intend them to operate. Within financial services, there hadn't been that choice. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we had sort of this tsunami in 1995 when the internet arrived. Through the natural consolidation of the main clearing banks, through the challenge that the technology base that they have all inherited, that they have, the ability then to deliver fintech solutions, fast solutions, extend the wider competitive marketplace through access to new technologies and new services simply couldn't happen with the existing structure. So what a new bank would be in a position to do if it was A, successful at being authorised, which I'm certain we'll come on to, but B, was able to deliver, would be potential market transformation in relation to access to services from a new supplier who was neutral and independent with no legacy. And that's not suggesting that there's anything wrong with the other ones. It's just saying sometimes in relation to creating transformation, new is better.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the payment service regulator, and Hannah Nixon, I think, seems to have been doing a very good job down there. And there's a lot of political interest and weight behind it. And she's a different model of regulator in terms of an economic regulator. I forgot whether she came from gas or electricity or something like that. Someone whose interest was in running a market which is a natural oligopoly, but trying to encourage competition and trying to get the price down for consumer and better service, which is a very different model from financial regulation around the world. I was reading something by John Kay yesterday about narrow banking from back in 2011-2012. He points out, and Lord Turner said the same thing, that a lot of what's called bank regulation is actually bank supervision. It's having people sitting in the cab over your shoulder telling you how to drive, which is a kind of madness of where the world's got to at the moment. But in terms of payments, and going back to clearing banks, I mean, I would have thought of it back in the day myself in a pre-Big Bang world, as kind of commercial banking. It's the plumbing, it's the nitty-gritty, it's where all the water flows, it's where all the electricity flows, in the basements, and it's the kind of thing that everyone took for granted, apart from the people who were in the basement, who knew how hard it was. And in terms of payments, I think I've told the story before, and I'll anonymise it. I was in a bank doing a gig some time ago, and I was told on the Monday, God, we had a nightmare of a weekend, we lost, you know, $1 trillion disappeared at some fuck-up.
Yep.
I go, that's quite a big number. That's the world of payments, where it's basically, I think, very similar in a sense to a utility.
It is.
The world relies on it. We don't notice it until it stops working, and then you've got no electricity in your house, and then you notice it.
I think that it is absolutely a utility service. You know, I joke that we are plumbers. We are probably plumbers. But the financial plumbing, as I mentioned earlier, is critical to all of us. It's very, very important. It works correctly. It's robust and all the rest of it. It's also very important. It's actually available to us all when we need it. And one of the challenges that the market faces is that historically we had branch banking. You used to go along, you used to know your bank manager, you used to go and see them and whatever. That's started to diminish and disappear. So your relationship with your bank has changed. Your banking has become digital, although I argue it really hasn't. All they've done is taken what was a checkbook and a paying upstone
and
stuck it on some web pages. There's nothing actually, you know, revolutionary in relation to online banking that I can really see. And effectively, where we have got to now in the marketplace was a position whereby competition and choice was very severely restricted. In the UK today, there are 400 regulated businesses that exist today. These aren't new challenger banks and all the rest of it. These are existing businesses who could provide current account services to 5 million UK consumers, making those UK consumers inclusive with organisations that they already have a tight financial relationship with. One of the examples of that is building societies who provide a mortgage, which is normally the largest single financial transaction that most consumers will ever make. Very important. The relationship of trust between the building society and the borrower is key. And that relationship will grow because the person may move house, they may want to build an extension, all the rest of it. The best way for that building society to really understand its customer is to see how that customer operates their finances. walking in to a branch of a building society with 6 months' historic bank statements and leaving them on somebody's desk is not the best way of demonstrating the way that you manage your finances and all the rest of it. Operating your current account through that building society so that you can save with them, so that you can create deposit accounts on the fly that you require, so your kids can create deposit accounts and save their pocket money, is the way that you get financial inclusion, which has a complete symbiotic benefit for both parties in that transaction, both the building society and the borrower.
Yes, it's interesting using these old phrases, because like most fashions that come in, they meet a need at the time and then they cause another problem which causes another need, and sometimes you go back to the future. And I mentioned earlier narrow banking, and of course building society is the archetypal narrow banking. It's the opposite of these sort of global mega banks that are far too big to actually sort of manage or anybody know what's going on, and they make a lot of sense. So in terms of ClearBank joining the party in the UK and being a new entrant, then obviously one aspect is the technology, because as I mentioned, I think there's formally 11, but in practice, as you say, there's only sort of four real players, substantial players, and I'm sure all of their roots go back 250 years.
Yes, they do.
And probably some of their IT systems go back 250 years before even computers existed, and some of them to 60s using COBOL that's compiled and no one has the source language anymore, etc., etc. So obviously you guys can buy new technology, which apart from the sort of the interest to IT folks about which app you're buying and which system and yada, yada, yada. In terms of how users can interface with you, it presumably enables you, coming back to your point about commercial banking, to offer different types of service, different digital clearing bank services that aren't done at the moment, that aren't just, as you say, as it were, sticking it on the internet, therefore calling it digital because you've got a web page.
Yeah, again, onto another boring bit, time to put the kettle on again. But one of the things that's quite important if you're running a financial institution is liquidity, which means that, you know, people are able to basically spend and use their own money according to their choice at the moment in time. One of the key things that we wanted to do when we're looking to build ClearBank was to give our customers real, true, accurate visibility of their payment flows and payment transactions. This had never been done before. Now, you might say, why? I don't know the answer to that one, but nobody had ever pulled together the outputs from the three clearing schemes, consolidated them together into a single screen, so that as a financial institution, I can see my inflows and outflows in real time, and I can drill down into those inflows and I can see who's authorised a payment, what the payment's for, who it's going to and who signed it.
And by the three schemes you mean?
CHAPS, BACS and Faster Payments. Because what we have done within ClearBank, and we've been working on this since 2014, we were authorised in December of last year, we announced ourselves to the world 28th of February, is that we're going through a slow build-up, progressive build-up of bringing customers on board through the back end of this year and throughout the whole of 2018. We're deliberately doing that slowly because we've been given a massive opportunity and an equally larger responsibility to try and change the shape of the marketplace in the UK by the regulators. And we ought to do that carefully. The reason why we also need to do that carefully is that our customers are creating innovative financial solutions which have great potential in the marketplace. Historically, if I wanted to go along and create a new payment scheme or a new app or a new service, right? Guess what I have to do? I have to connect that to a bank. If that service is competitive to that bank, it's a pretty tough conversation to have. Understandably, from both parties' position, we don't have that limitation. We don't compete in the consumer market space, so we encourage our regulated customers to be innovative, to come up with ideas of new ways of addressing market need, market change, and creating interesting digital applications, not just web pages from a statement.
Indeed, and when you were talking, I was thinking of the example of Go Cardless, who were on the show a year or two ago, and they've done a very good job of connecting direct debits in different countries. The push, hang on, that's push, isn't it? Yes, standing order is pull. Anyway, I'll get it mixed up. One of those, it's either push or pull. It's not the credit card version. Around different countries, and I remember asking Hiroki, oh, so let's say you want to do Canada. You go out there and you tell the guys, hey, I want to do Canada. Have they finished it by Monday morning or does it take a bit longer? And he said it takes a bit longer. I said, how much longer? He said, about a year to set up all the banking relationships. And
it is.
You know, dardy, dardy, dardy. So again, clearing banking is the kind of stuff that's taken for granted in the way that electricity grid is taken for granted by everybody who uses it but doesn't know about it. But actually, when you get into it, there is quite a lot of arcane stuff and there is a whole bunch of conflicts of interest in there. And just simply precedent. Oh, we've always done it this way. It takes this long. And so I can see that someone else coming along can do it in a fresher way. And in terms of customers, you use the word customers, what types of firm, without mentioning any names, or mention names you want, but what types of firm come to you for what kind of stuff? And what are they walking away going, oh, wow, we've got ClearBank, and I've got to call my mum tomorrow because now what I can do? I never do it before.
We've got UK banks, building societies, credit unions, financial institutions, from the very biggest in this country and some of the very biggest globally, down to some of the smallest in conversations with at the moment. We completely underestimated the market demand for change in the UK in relation to choice, neutrality and independence. ClearBank's unique in that all of the funds that we hold for our customers sits in the Bank of England. So in the event of all of our customers deciding they would all like their money back, they can form an orderly queue and we will give it all back to them instantaneously whenever they ask for it.
So you're not leveraging?
That creates a very, very stable environment for them.
It's actually a bit of a coincidence in a way, or synchronicity, because I tend to sort of sort all these shows out in advance and people change dates in the diary and this happens and that happens. So the order in which they come out tends to be a bit random, but we were just talking on the podcast, which I was editing this morning, but which will be released 2 weeks before yours, about the Bank of England's plans or ideas around having digital Bank of England cash. And
yep.
The point that I was ramming home time and time again, and apologies to everybody who listened 2 weeks ago, but at least you'll never forget it, which is that we all are familiar with two types of money. There's the cash and notes in our pocket, and there's the numbers in our bank account. We think that's all money is. But actually, there's this third thing, which the likes of ClearBank and commercial banks are allowed to use, but no one else is, which is these central bank reserves or money out to the Bank of England. And that's
correct.
That is a very different type of money. And the Bank of England has been very busy creating lots of it because it created $500 trillion for quantitative easing. Now, let's not go down that direction. But anyway, of course, as you all know from last year, one of the ideas that they're looking at is actually expanding the usage of that. And one of the benefits of, let's call it digital cash, call it central bank reserves, I'm not worried about the economically precise phrase, is it has a characteristic which is very similar or the same as cash. If you've got a few £5 notes in your pocket, that's it, and I ask for them back, you give them to me. It's very different from this funny money that sort of private banks have been creating in this massive pyramid, where if everybody turns up to Northern Rock at the same time and asks for their money back, it'll be on the 6 o'clock news before you know it, and there won't be enough to go around. So, you know, that's a huge leap forward.
I think that everybody in the world learnt lessons from the global financial crisis. I was in Iceland the day that the Icelandic currency collapsed.
Ah, well, as I've told the story before, I was doing a gig for Landsbanki at the time. When Landsbanki went down the pan, and they owed me 5 months' money as well, which is unlucky.
Anyway, we were at a Visa meeting, the card scheme meeting, and by mid-afternoon, or before mid-afternoon, it was quite clear that our Icelandic hosts were getting somewhat paler and paler as the minutes of the day ticked on. And so the meeting was called to a halt. We all went back to our hotel because Gerd Herder, who was the Prime Minister then, was going to address the nation. I'll never forget that day because we were staying in the Radisson in Reykjavik, went down to the bar area to watch this huge TV to listen to this announcement being made, and we understood nothing of it. But it was one of those things you felt you had to be there because history was being made. And the waiter who'd served us breakfast that morning was standing very close to us, watching this thing and listening to what was being said in tears. So we said to him, look, you know, are you all right? Do you want to sit down or whatever? We don't quite understand what this is going on, but we know that it's not good news day. And he said, you know, he said, I've spent the last year saving and saving and saving, right, to go to university. And tomorrow morning I was going to convert all of my Icelandic krona into euros to pay my university fees. And now I can't. And I sometimes wish that some of the many bankers around the world who forgot that they were actually looking after somebody else's money and it wasn't actually their money could have been with us that day in that bar to have seen the impact of their actions on that young lad. And I often wonder whether he actually ever managed to get to university. He probably did.
Yes, well, probably an Icelandic university, I'd guess. I mean, finance can sound terribly abstract for the rest of the country, but it's stories like that which render it completely real. And
yep.
I think the Icelandics, bless their souls, I did enjoy working with them, I like them as people and the culture. They're very interesting. Their favourite words seem to be nay, which was no. They just have great enthusiasm about saying no to things. And I didn't hear the word yes very often, actually, but maybe it was just my chums up there. But they did actually get currencies completely wrong. So the other problem they had around there was that lots of them had realised that Swiss interest rates, for example, were lower, so therefore it's cheaper to have a mortgage in Swiss francs.
Yeah.
And just as your waiter was crying, they were probably crying quite a lot as well because the value of their mortgage had just tripled overnight.
That all blew up in their face badly. But anyway, I do assume that you tried some of the likely rotting smoked shark fin or whatever they have up there as a delicacy with Black Death, which I think is the liquor that you swig down.
Yes, I was very careful, actually, because those Vikings can drink.
Moving on.
Moving swiftly on, he says, developing a headache. So anyway, so coming back to the big point here, though, is that the client funds are in the second type of money, or third type of money, what you want to think of it, the one that people aren't aware of, which is, should we call it, central bank money.
Yep.
And that has a very, very, very special characteristic in that it isn't pyramided up. Or actually, it's a whole new podcast in itself, where the money that Bank of England makes comes from. But anyway, you can consider it as electronic coinage. In a sense. So the interesting thing here is that innovation is often interpreted in the context of doing something different, like when you connected the Channel Islands to this sort of internet thing and you went around telling all your mates at the golf club, oh, there's this internet and it's really interesting and I can sell you a connection. And
I think we call it the information superhighway. Well,
there we go. You see, you're a marketing guy, you see. I'm a sort of ex-risk guy. I just tell it like it is. So there is a type of innovation which is doing something the world ain't seen before, but there's a different type, which is, you know, maintaining the same spirit of doing something that hasn't been seen before, but actually changing something that's been around for a hell of a long time that you're doing it and looking at it from afresh. And I assume that your time, the likes of Worldpay and all that sort of kind of stuff, gave you long enough exposure to look at the way that things are done. And occasionally when you're sitting on a beach staring out to sea, you think, well, it doesn't have to be done this way.
Correct. Correct. I mean, in the market that we operate, there is so much friction. And in financial services, friction equals cost. And so the more friction you can remove, the more straight-through processing that you can create, A, there's an impact on cost, but there's a massive impact on customer satisfaction. That's really, really important because, you know, if I want to make a payment today, let's assume, you know, I'm running a business in London and I'd like to make a payment to one of my suppliers in Chicago. I'll send that through my bank. And it may get there. There's no guarantee it's going to get there. There's no guarantee it will arrive on a particular moment in time. We can send a payment today from here to Australia, right? Or from Australia to here. In fact, we did it. We took a payment out of an Australian bank account into the UK sterling, across onto an NFC phone, out and bought a cup of Starbucks in Liverpool Street Station. The transaction time was less than 1 millisecond. So the technology works. The market doesn't. And over the course of the next few years, we know we've made our first step into the market in 2017. Hopefully over the course of the next few years, we'll make a few more smaller steps and try and remove some of the friction. And that will improve the quality of service and the reliability of service, right? And the satisfaction of hopefully many of the customers of the banks and building societies and organisations that we are serving.
Absolutely. And for all fintechs listening, you know, if you buddy up with ClearBank, then you can start seeing immediately how you can offer something that's radically different, even if they have a poor taste in coffee. So we didn't have time to sort of dive into ClearBank as such. We can wrap up and you can explain a little bit about what you're selling to who and who of the thousands of listeners should actually check you guys out. But I think one of the takeaways that looking at your website was something along the lines that you don't use third-party services anyway, you do it all kind of in-house or something. And talking about different banks and all that, Monzo, I had a number of outages this year, and I use Monzo card on holiday, and I quite like the geolocated expenses and all that kind of stuff. And I dared tweet, and I say I dared because it's becoming un-PC to criticise the likes of Monzo, lots of Monzo fanboys who jump on you immediately. I tweeted saying, and I'm a big fan of Monzo, I've even got sort of shares, I hold £200 worth of shares, so if they go up a millionfold, I'll be rich. I dared to tweet, how long will it be before people start losing patience with Monzo, who are correctly saying, oh, it's our supplier that's let us down. Once you're doing that, as Giles Andrews from Zopa said, you're just a reseller. You're reselling somebody else's product. You're putting lipstick on a pig. Nice lipstick, pig looks prettier. But actually, there's a world of difference, and that's a practical example. I'm not criticising them. When they open their current accounts, they're going to bring it all in-house, yardy, yardy, yardy. But there was this theory going around for some time, which is that, in a sense, like an entrepreneur is somebody who identifies allocates and organizes resources, and that's what the entrepreneur does.
Yeah.
Well, okay, yeah, to an extent, but if all you're doing is lining up external services from people who aren't 100% reliable, then it's your reputation that goes down the plug hole.
Correct.
It's a bit like Sainsbury's blaming the fish farmer for the salmon, giving your whole family sort of jippy tummy. No, that's no good, because actually it's Sainsbury's that I care about. And if I'm looking to Monzo or I'm looking to Clearbank, I want to look at you and say, mate, I don't want excuses.
No, you're absolutely right. What we did was that in 2014, when we kicked off all the discussions around creating this, was I was very, very clear that we wanted to build all our own technology and we had to be completely standalone and not reliant upon any other bank. That means that if something does go wrong, then we put our paws up to it and we say we're very, very sorry. The other option to that is you go out and you have multi-party sourcing relationships. So you go and buy a whole raft of different software products and you make, you know, the software vendors entirely happy and all the rest of it. But then you've got to create the glue that sticks all of that lot together. And you're then at the whim of whether one of those software vendors will change its products and have an impact on you. So we were very, very lucky. We partnered at a very early stage with Microsoft in relation to working with them on the Azure cloud. And Microsoft don't have an interest in us. It's a commercial relationship with them. But we went with Microsoft because of the focus and attention that they were putting into cybercrime and cybersecurity. That was really important for us because every bank in the world has somebody knocking at their front door. Every business has it. Every consumer has it. And so we thought it was very, really important to find a vendor that was actually putting investment into that correctly. And they're putting about $6 billion a year
Wow.
into that, which is more than any bank in the UK or the rest of the world can afford to spend. So that was effectively like, you know, finding our chum in the playground to stop the bullies getting at us. So from that, we then built out a complete new IT platform ourselves. Started with all our tech guys in Ropemaker Street, and we've been at various different locations around London to, you know, where we now have 110 souls working with us here in the Gherkin. Doesn't mean it's not going to fail. You know, it's bomb-proof. But it does mean that we understand every part of it. It does mean that we've gone through testing of that system extensively. And if it does fail, we know exactly what we've got to do. We've got to put our hands up and apologise to our customers and fix it quick.
Yes, but the important point being that you can fix it within, quote, your own four walls.
We can fix it within our own four
walls. Rather than having to have conversations and shouting at people who themselves may not be able to fix it with their own four walls.
We have a number of relationships in relation to getting credit reference data and various other things from other parties, but nothing directly ourselves. And so it gives us, I think, the ability to both have responsibility to our customers, but also be in a position to happily convert that into contractual obligations. That's the second thing that we've done in the marketplace that didn't exist before, putting our paws up and saying we'll be responsible and we'll commit to you for the services that we are delivering to you, which are vital to your organisation.
Right. OK, well, before we wrap up, just saying a little bit about what ClearBank are offering as services and listening to you talk, actually, in a way, a clearing bank, of course, is a technical phrase, a bunch of history and all that, and it will mean a hell of a lot to people in the industry. I mean, a lot of sort of fintechs, and also actually quite a lot of bankers, will be a little bit confused around the phrase. And I wonder whether we can't sort of talk about some of what you're doing, not using the phrase clearing bank, for these people less familiar with it in terms of what you're offering. But before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. I hope all your payments are working well today. And I'd like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, secured peer-to-peer business lending, connecting businesses requiring finance with investors seeking a secure and favourable return of up to 9% per annum. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrolment.co.uk. Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries, and $400 million of revenue. So, Nick, we've touched on ClearBank a number of times in the context of this, but in terms of throwing breadcrumbs on the water to the 4,000 or 5,000 listeners out there who stretch from incumbents to new fintechs, maybe we can have a sentence or two without the phrase clearing bank in it.
Okay.
People who have certain needs in business, what are those kind of needs that you can meet for them?
Basically, there's another phrase that's used, which isn't clearing bank, is agency banks. An agency bank is a service that is consumed probably by a number of the people who are listening to this right now. Agency banking means that the organisation consumes payment services from us and uses them for the benefit of their own customers. So if any of your fintechs or regulated businesses are looking for an alternative choice or a new way of accessing the payment schemes and systems using very, very advanced technology, we use ISO 2022, we have an API, we have all of the latest ways of connecting into our systems, then they should just go to clear.bank, that's our URL, and we will look forward to talking to them and seeing if we can help them.
And in terms of the range of services you're providing in that respect, are you offering whatever it's called, gateway access to FPS?
We provide gateway access to faster payments. We are a faster payments member ourselves. We provide straight through processing. Most people require FPS and BACS and then potentially chats for larger value payments. All of that is available and consumed via a single API. So what we allow is the organization comes to us. It's very, very simple. I mean, we could have made it complicated. We chose not to. So they come to us and they say, we'd like to open a bank account with you because, hey, guess what? We're a bank. All right. So we take them through the boring KYC, AML process, all of the stuff that you have to go through for onboarding. And then we give them an option. All right. The option is you can either use our portal to access our services, a bit like online banking that people use at home. You can use our API to access our services where they put a technical integration into their existing systems and access it that way. Or if you are authorized and capable to offer current account services, we have a complete white label system which allows them to offer current account services directly to their customers. And that is it.
Right. So one or two fintechs have been on the show have been e-money issuers.
Yep. E-money issuers can issue current accounts.
Yes, they can issue current accounts and they don't quite do as well as you. But for example, they might take all their current accounts and they have to keep all the money, but they keep it with a commercial bank like, say, NatWest or something like that, which of course isn't quite as secure as the money of the central bank.
One of the differences as well is if they're a regulated business. So yes, they come to us, we provide exactly the same services. Their money sits in the central bank, it's all secure. And we share the Reserve Bank interest with them. So they actually have an income stream from that, which hasn't been available in the marketplace.
Right. OK. Well, having started with sort of history and 250 years ago and having done two podcasts in a row where I mentioned history, I think I'm going to have the next dozen podcasts off history. And given that we have an international audience and banking phrases vary around the world, I think agency bank may be a simpler one, or just simplistically put for sort of non-financial services people, ClearBank offer payment services, which you can use in your organization and plug into very simply. And for anybody who understands it in a more sophisticated version of that and knows that I've just oversimplified it, well, I guess you should check out clear.bank, as they are the new kids on the block. And it's quite clear from listening to Nick to all, I'm sure, that Nick is someone with a huge amount of experience in this. Worldpay is a FTSE 100. It's not like a successful fintech that's got to sort of 250 people. And in particular, there are huge advantages to being into this world of exchanging pieces of paper, electronic bits and money going all over the place that come from starting with a clean sheet as a 21st century company in the first place, because anybody who's in existing clearing banks, commercial banks near this area knows what a nightmare it is to keep all the systems going along. And it's a job that one wouldn't necessarily volunteer for oneself. So I'm very interested to hear, Nick, about ClearBank, and in particular, I'm always curious how one breaks into an oligopolies, given that the whole world is oligopolies, be it telecoms, be it electricity, be it clearing banking. And I always think it must be a hell of a job, but cometh the time, cometh the man, by the sound of it. So thank you very much for that.
The only thing I'd add to the end of that is that the answer's always no, unless you ask the question. So, Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. Oh. are wild, like the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.